Okay, continue by outline books to page 10. Now again, we're dealing with three broad areas in this course. We first of all deal with bibliology, not all of bibliology, but that part of bibliology that is directly relevant to how correctly interpreting the Bible. We finished that last week and we discussed the issues of revelation, inspiration, illumination. And then last week we dealt with the various rules of interpretation. And while I gave you quite a number, the most important one, again, is this one here, the Gault-Newlove interpretation. When the plain sense of Scripture makes common sense, seek no other sense, therefore take every word as primary, ordinary, usual, literal meaning, lest the facts of the immediate context, cited in the light of related passages, and axiomatic and fundamental truths indicate clearly otherwise. As long as you stay consistent with this rule, you will be limiting any errors. We're all going to make errors still, but I'll be much more limited by a consistent application of this rule. Now today and next week, we'll spend two sessions on this, the second main area, which has to do with the dispensations and dispensationalism. What I want to cover tonight is page 10, page 11, page 12, and page 13. 10, 11, 12, and 13 will be my goal for tonight. We did manage this in the morning. And then next week, today we're going to present exactly what dispensationalism is and what it is not. And then we're going to compare that next week with one of the major forms of replacement theology, which is called covenant theology. Now, what makes dispensationalism unique against all the other theologies is that it does not hold to any form of replacement theology, does not teach the church has replaced Israel in God's plan and program. All the other theologies, to a lesser or greater degree at some point, replace Israel by the church. And while there's more than one form of replacement theology, the major form here in the USA, not in Europe necessarily, but here in the USA, is covenant theology, and we'll make comparisons starting next week. So we're going to spend 2 days on dispensations and dispensationalism, and then the remaining sessions we have to the end of March will be under covenants. All right, so on your outline, we'll begin with capital A, what is a dispensation? We begin with the etymology. The English word dispensation comes from the Latin word dispensatio, dispensatio. And when Jerome translated the Bible into Latin, what became the Latin Vulgate, this is the word he used to translate the Greek word for dispensation. But the basic meaning of the Latin term is to weigh out or to dispense, to weigh out or to dispense. And the principal ideas in the English word dispensation involves the act of dealing out or distributing, the act of dealing out or distributing. It's the act of administrating, ordering, managing any system that requires a form of management to be administered. You also have the basic element of dispensing, like dispensing with a specific requirement, but the primary ideas of administration. We get to the Greek words. The main Greek word primarily is the word oikonomia. Oikonomia means to manage, to regulate, to administer, and to plan. To manage, to regulate, to administer, and to plan. It's a combination of two Greek words made into one. The first Greek word is oikos, which means house. Oikos means house, and then nomos, which means law or rule. Nomos, which means law or rule. And the basic meaning of the Greek word then is to divide, to deportion, administer, or manage the affairs of an inhabited house. To divide, to apportion, to administer, to manage, to regulate the affairs of an inhabited house. And so keep in mind the central idea of a dispensation is a dispensation is managing or administering the affairs of a household. A dispensation is that of managing or administering the affairs of a household. The word itself does not carry a time element. You sometimes hear people say these are seven periods of time, but actually the word dispensation does not carry a time element, only carries a system of administration. The Greek word that carries a time element is the next one, aion. Aion means age. Aion means age, and when this word is attached to a concept of dispensation, it's this word that gives a dispensation a time element. The time element, again, is not in the word dispensation, but obviously every dispensation, every administration has to be carried out within a period of time. What gives it the time element is aion. Let me give a mundane administration. For example, we say something like the Reagan administration, Clinton administration, Bush administration. That just tells you the system of running the household, which in this case happens to be the whole country. The word administration doesn't carry a time element. It just gives you the specific system by which things are ordered. Now, the Constitution is that a president runs for 4-year terms, and he can never run for more than twice or more than once rerunning. Therefore, the max amount of any administration is 8 years. So every president goes for 4, and he's reelected for 8 years. But it's the Constitution that provides the time element, not the word administration. By the same token, the word dispensation is simply the administration. The time element is in the word aion. So small c, as far as conclusion is concerned, as to content and meaning, a dispensation is a stewardship. A dispensation is a stewardship. As to time, it is an age. As to time, it is an age. Any questions on the definition itself? That's good. All right, let's go to point two, scriptural usages of the word. The word oikonomia is used a total of 20 times in the New Testament. It's a Greek word, so it would only appear in the New Testament. But it's found 20 times in three different forms. The first form is oikonomeo. Oikonomeo is a verb. As a verb, it appears only once. Luke chapter 16, verse 2. Luke 16, verse 2, where it means to be a steward. To be a steward. The second form of the word is oikonomos. Oikonomos means, is a noun, which means a steward. It's a noun which means a steward. It's used 10 times. Luke chapter 12, verse 42, Luke 12, 42. Luke chapter 16, verses 1, 3, and 8. Luke 16, verses 1, 3, and 8. Romans chapter 16, verse 23. Romans 16, 23. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1 and 2. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 1 and 2. Galatians chapter 4, verse 2, Galatians 4, 2. Titus chapter 1, verse 7, Titus 1, 7. And 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 10, 1 Peter 4, 10. And the third form it appears as is oikonomia, also a noun. But in this case, it means stewardship or dispensation. stewardship or dispensation. This is found in Luke chapter 16, verses 2 through 4, Luke 16, 2 to 4, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 17, 1 Corinthians 9, 17, Ephesians chapter 1, verse 10, Ephesians 1, 10, chapter 3, verse 2, and verse 9, chapter 3, verse 2, and verse 9, Colossians chapter 1, verse 25, Colossians 1, 25, and 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 4, 1 Timothy 1, 4, dispensation or stewardship. Now, small being here outlined the features displayed, and parenthetical one, the parabolic usage and its four features. Turn with me now to the Luke 12 passage. Luke 12. In two parables he dealt with, uses the word, and we'll look at the two passages and draw these four observations. Okay, first of all, Luke chapter 12 and look at verse 42. Luke 12, verse 42. And the Lord said, "Who then is the faithful and wise steward?" There's our key word. "Whom his Lord shall set over his household to give them their portion of food in due season." Notice, a steward is given authority over a household for the purpose of distributing certain things. Now go to chapter 16. Luke chapter 16. Look at verse 1. Luke 16, verse 1. "It said also unto the disciples, there was a certain rich man who had a steward. The same was accused unto him that he was wasting his goods. And he called him and said unto him, What is this that I hear of you? Render the account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be steward. The steward said within himself, What shall I do, seeing that my Lord takes away the stewardship from me? I have not strength to dig, to beg am ashamed. I am resolved what to do, that when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their households." Listen, both passages in the parabolic usage, it concerns the management of a household by a steward, and note four things. First of all, there are two parties involved. The first party is the owner, who has the authority to delegate duties. The owner of the house who has the authority to delegate duties. And secondly, the steward, who is responsible to carry the duties out. The steward then has the power to carry, responsibility to carry the duties out. A second thing to observe here is that there are specific responsibilities. There are specific responsibilities the steward has, and he must carry out those responsibilities in managing the household of his Lord. The third thing we see in these parabolic passages is accountability is part of the arrangement. Accountability is part of the arrangement. A steward, like we see the one here in chapter 16, a steward may be called upon to give an account of his stewardship. A steward could be called upon to give an account of how he discharged his stewardship, especially if there is suspicion he may have, like this one, he may have misused his office. And the fourth observation to make is a change could be made any time unfaithfulness is found in an existing administration. A change of stewards and stewardship could be made if there is unfaithfulness found in existing administration. And this steward here was given us 2-week notice, so to speak. Now, parenthetical to other usages and their six features. When we go outside the Gospels, within the Gospels, it's used only in these Luke passages. Outside the Gospel, it's a term used only by Paul with one exception. The one exception is the 1 Peter 4:10 passage I gave you earlier. Outside of 1 Peter 4:10, it's a word used exclusively by the Apostle Paul. Let's note six things from these passages. First of all, God is the one to whom men are responsible to in discharging their stewardship. God is the one men are responsible to in the discharge of the stewardship. For example, 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1 and 2, 1 Corinthians 4, verse 1 and 2, let a man so account of us as ministers of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Here, moreover, it is required in stewards that the man be found faithful. And so dealing with stewardship, dispensations, God is the one men are responsible to in this charge of the stewardship. But besides 1 Corinthians 4, verse 1 and 2, it's also reaffirmed in Titus chapter 1, verse 7. Titus chapter 1, verse 7. A second feature to note is faithfulness is required to whom a dispensational responsibility is given. Faithfulness is required of those to whom a dispensational responsibility is committed, as it is here in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 2, 1 Corinthians 4, 2. A third thing to observe is a stewardship may end at an appointed time. A stewardship could end at a specific appointed time. Galatians 4, verses 4 through 7. Galatians 4, verses 4 through 7. Verse 4 says, but when the fullness of the time came, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under law, that he might redeem them under law, to might receive the adoption of sons. And because you are sons, God has sent forth the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father, so that you are no longer a bond servant, but a son, if a son, an heir through God. As Pastor shows is that at some point by God's own appointment, a specific stewardship came to an end because of a different purpose being introduced. A different purpose is now introduced, and therefore a new dispensation begins. And this reference again shows a dispensation, while it does not carry element of time, is connected with time. A fourth thing to note is this. Dispensations are connected with the mysteries of God. Dispensations are connected with the mysteries of God, but what do we mean by the term mystery? In modern-day English, the word mystery means something we don't quite understand, something we don't have an answer to, something inexplicable, like the TV show that was on the air one time called Unsolved Mysteries. That is the English usage of the term that is not the same as the biblical usage in the New Testament. In the New Testament, the word mystery is a very technical term, always refers to this. Something totally unrevealed in the Old Testament, revealed for the first time in the New. Something totally unrevealed in the Old Testament, revealed for the first time in the New. Whatever is knowable from the Old Testament does not qualify to be a mystery. A mystery is only knowable from the New Testament. Already in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 1, which I read a few moments ago, 1 Corinthians 4:1, he talked about the dispensation of the mysteries. But how we derive that specific definition, turn to Ephesians chapter 3. Look at Ephesians chapter 3. Notice how the term mystery is defined. chapter 3, verse 3, chapter 3, verse 3. Let's go back to verse 2. If so be that ye have heard of the dispensation of that grace that God has given me to you, word, how that by revelation was made known unto me the mystery, this is our word, as I wrote before in a few words, whereby when you read it and perceive my understanding in the mystery, again, the word of Christ. Now notice how he defines it in verse 5, which in other generations was not made known unto sons of men, as has now been revealed unto his holy apostles and prophets and spirit. Note the mystery is something totally unrevealed in all previous generations, only now being revealed in New Testament times, that is, to his apostles and New Testament prophets. Let's skip down to verse 9. Verse 9, to make all men see what is the dispensation of the mystery, which for ages have been hid in God, who created all things. So the dispensation of the mystery has been hidden for ages. Hidden for dispensations, only now being revealed. Look at one more passage, Colossians 1. Colossians 1. Verse 25. Wherefore I was made a minister according to the dispensation of God which was given me to you, were to fulfill the word of God, even the mystery, which hath been hid for ages and generations, but now has been manifested to his saints. Here again, unrevealed in the past, revealed for the first time in the new. So now these things are knowable, now they are understandable, because they have finally been revealed. So in English, mystery is something we cannot yet explain. In New Testament Greek, it's something we now are able to explain because it has been revealed. Altogether, by the way, there are 10 mysteries, 8 of which are divine mysteries, and 2 of which are satanic mysteries. It goes beyond our purpose in this course to deal with this details. It's available in the manuscript of Mariel Ministries. But there are 8 mysteries which are divine and 2 mysteries which are satanic. As often with these mysteries, the word dispensation was used. Now, fifthly, dispensation and age are connected ideas, but they're not the same or interchangeable. Dispensation and age are connected ideas, but they're not the same or interchangeable. And while dispensation does not have an element of time, the dispensation operates within a time period. The sixth thing is at least 3 different dispensations are mentioned in Paul's writings. Not the only 3, but 3 specific ones are mentioned in his writings. In Ephesians chapter 1, verse 10, he talks about the dispensation of the fullness of the time. The dispensation of the fullness of the time, it's a reference to the future dispensation, that of the Messianic Kingdom. In Ephesians chapter 3, verse 2, he talks about the dispensation of the grace of God, the dispensation of the grace of God, which is the present dispensation in which we now live. And in Colossians 1, verse 25 and 26, he spoke of a dispensation preceding the present one, which would be the dispensation of the law. So from these usages, both in the Gospels in parabolic form and in the epistles, go to point 3, the definition of a dispensation. And the way Charles Ryrie has defined it, it's defined as follows. It's a distinguishable economy in the outworking of God's purpose. a dispensation is a distinguishable economy in the outworking of God's purpose. Let's break definition down. Look first of all at the word economy, a distinguishable economy. What that word implies is that as you compare certain dispensations, certain things are the same. And so as you move from one dispensation to the other, certain things will be the same. For example, except for the first dispensation, the means of forgiveness was always by means of shedding blood. There had to be a life-for-life exchange. The means of atonement was always by means of blood. The difference is, then it was animal blood, now it's Messiah's blood, but the blood element was always there for all but the first one. So word economy means that certain things among the dispensations will be the same or similar. Now look at the word distinguishable. The word distinguishable means that some features are distinctive to each dispensation. Some features are distinctive to each dispensation. So some features are distinctive, which marks one dispensation off from another. The third phrase to look at is the outworking of God's purpose. The outworking of God's purpose, because the viewpoint of distinguishing the dispensations is from God's perspective, not man's perspective. God determines when one dispensation ends and one begins. And so from a human perspective, how do we know when a new dispensation has come into being? Well, we see three things happening. When you see three things happening, one dispensation has come to an end, the new one has begun. The first element is some regulations continue into a new dispensation. Some previous regulations continue into the new one. But secondly, there's an annulment, a cancellation, a discontinuing of some other regulations. So some regulations continue from one dispensation to the other, but some regulations change from one dispensation to another. So what may be immoral now is necessarily always immoral. And what's permissible to be eaten now is not always permissible to be eaten in the past. Let me just take a couple of examples. We'll say more about these in covenants starting 2 weeks from now. But take the issue of eating. From Adam to Noah, man was to be purely vegetarian. No meat was eaten, allowed to be eaten. From Adam to Noah, man was purely vegetarian. From Noah to Moses, man could eat any kind of meat he chooses. No limitations. As we'll see, we talk about Noahic covenant. He says, every moving thing shall be food for you. The Mosaic law came into being, while the Gentiles still could eat what they wished, Jews were limited to what they could eat. Only certain kinds of meats, only certain kinds of fowls, only certain kinds of fish, and only one kind of insect. With Messiah's death, all meats are clean again. But take some moral issues. When did marrying your sister or your half-sister become immoral? When did marrying a sister, your half-sister, become immoral? Only with Moses. Obviously, the children of Adam and Eve had to marry siblings. They had no other options. But even past the time of Adam and Eve, brothers and sister marriages were allowed. For example, Who did Abraham marry? He married his half-sister. Was he immoral? No, he wasn't. The law had not yet been given. It was also immoral to marry two sisters. Did Jacob sin by marrying two sisters? No, that was before the Mosaic commandment was given. The Mosaic Law, so for example, forbids a niece marrying her uncle or a nephew marrying his aunt. A nephew was not allowed to marry his aunt. That was immoral. But guess what kind of marriage the parents of Moses had? The father of Moses married his aunt. And the kind of what was forbidden in Mosaic Law is exactly the kind of marriage that Moses came out of, from his parents. Because these different dispensations are simply different rules of life. They're not seven ways of being saved. That should be remembered. Now, those who criticize our position will often accuse us using false logic that we believe in different ways of salvation, like seven ways of salvation. The different dispensations are not different ways of salvation. They're simply different rules of life. As we'll see, salvation was always by grace through faith. But the rule of life I live under was not the same one that Moses lived under. And what he lived under was not the same as Abraham lived under. So number one, there is a continuation of certain regulations. Secondly, there is a discontinuing of certain regulations. But thirdly, new regulations are brought in, not seen before. New regulations are brought in, not seen before. When these three things happen, only then do you have the start of a new dispensation. And again, each dispensation is simply a stage in the progressive revelation of God. We have a distinctive stewardship, a distinctive rule of life. I'll read you a more extended definition that comes out of Rari's book called Dispensationalism. Don't try to write all this down, just kind of listen to it. Quote, dispensationalism views the world as a household run by God. In this household world, God is dispensing or administering its affairs according to his own will and in various stages of revelation in the process of time. These various stages mark off the distinguishable different economies in the outworking of his total purpose, and these economies are the dispensations. The understanding of God's different economies is essential to a proper interpretation of his revelation within these various economies, end of quote. So let's look at three different distinctives, different viewpoints of what dispensation is. From the viewpoint of God, a dispensation is an economy. From the viewpoint of God, a dispensation is an economy. Second, from the viewpoint of man, a dispensation is a responsibility. A dispensation is a responsibility. And thirdly, from the viewpoint of progressive revelation, from the viewpoint of progressive revelation, it's one stage in it. All right, any questions on this segment, on the points 2 and 3? Any questions here?
Many times you hear people talk about dispensations, the dispensation of grace in terms of ways of salvation, and the law in terms of ways of salvation. So obviously that's a misinterpretation of the dispensations, correct?
Correct. Dispensations are different rules of life, not different ways of salvation, which we will get into more next week.
In the usage in the sixth feature in all three writings, the second Ephesians scripture and what
is it? Ephesians 3 verse 2.
And what was it?
Ephesians 1:10. Any other questions? All right, let's go to point four, the characteristics of a dispensation. Small a, primary characteristics. Let me give you three primary characteristics. First of all, there is a change in God's governmental relationship with men. A change in God's governmental relationship with men. Secondly, there is a resulting change in man's responsibility. A resulting change in man's responsibility. And thirdly, there's a corresponding revelation necessary to effect that change, a corresponding revelation necessary to effect the change. Again, here we see progressive revelation in that God did not choose to give it all at one time, but has given us over a 1600-year period before the Bible was complete. These three primary characteristics is the essence of what marks a dispensation. When God is small b secondary, these only secondary, they're not major, and a dispensation can exist without them. I give you three secondary characteristics, but not essential for a dispensation to exist. The essential element is the first three, which are primary. Now, the first secondary characteristic is the test, the human responsibility, and the question is, will man respond favorably towards the responsibility of a particular economy under which he's living? Will he respond favorably towards the responsibility of a specific economy under which he's living? And again, these tests are not ways of salvation. Man was always saved by grace through faith plus nothing. They're not ways of getting saved. But these tests will show that man is helpless to achieve his own righteousness, and that should drive him to faith in the God of Israel. So he could be saved by grace through faith. A second secondary characteristic is the failure. And usually, there's failure in two areas. There is failure in the governmental economy. People do not obey the rules which are required. And secondly, there's a failure in salvation. They fail to exercise faith. Now, in every dispensation, some do not fail, but most do. And finally, when sin reaches a certain level, a certain point, this will lead to the end of a dispensation. When sin reaches to a certain level, that will lead to the end of a dispensation. And the third secondary characteristic is judgment. There'll sometimes be several judgments within a dispensation, such as within the dispensation of the law, there was the judgment of servitude in the book of Judges, there was the Assyrian captivity, the Babylonian captivity. Firstly, there is a climactic judgment, which in this case was the judgment of AD 70 with the destruction of the city, the temple, and the forced dispersion from the land. So again, as far as the third secondary usage, there could be judgment within, but it's often a climactic one that brings the dispensation to an end. A small c, the steward. Dispensations are stewardships, and each stewardship has its steward. And what you see in these dispensations, and we'll see that in the next hour, each dispensation begins with one specific individual who is the steward. Every stewardship, every dispensation begins with one individual who happens to be the steward. With the exception of the first and seventh dispensation, the steward does not live out the dispensation. He does with the first one, he does with the seventh one, but in dispensations 2 through 6, the key individual does not live out the whole dispensation. One more thing to note about the steward, the responsibility is not only upon the steward, but falls to everybody who lives under that stewardship. The responsibility does not fall only upon the steward, but falls upon all those living under that stewardship. So come to point 5, the mark of a dispensationalist. Let's clarify exactly what is and what is not a dispensationalist. Let me point out under small a, three things it's not. Should be on page 12. Okay, three things it's not. First of all, it's not merely recognizing that dispensations exist. It's not merely recognizing that dispensations exist. Even some non-dispensationalists, and one we'll be referring to next week, even some replacement theologians recognize different dispensations exist. Secondly, it's not the number of dispensations. Now, there is a minimum you have to hold. You have to believe in at least three different dispensations to be a dispensationalist. You have to at least believe in the Old Testament, New Testament, and the future kingdom. And I hold to seven different dispensations, but somebody can be dispensationalist and not hold to seven. It's not the number of dispensations that determine whether you're dispensationalist. And thirdly, it's not merely premillennialism. Many non-dispensationalists and replacement theologians are premillennial. They do believe in the future kingdom, but they're not dispensational. So small b, what is a dispensationalist? Two things are primary, and I'll give you a third thing which is not as essential, but fairly important. But two things are primary. The first primary issue is a consistent, literal, or plain hermeneutic, a consistent, literal, or plain interpretation. As or against spiritualizing or allegorizing the text. And the key word here is the word consistent, because all theologies do interpret parts of the Bible literally. Only dispensationalism interprets it consistently with the goal of interpretation, resorting to non-literal only if the text requires it, but not otherwise. And all forms of non-dispensational theologies violate the rule of consistency at some point. So it's not that we believe in literal and they don't believe in literal. It's they believe in literal interpretation to certain parts of the Bible. But they allegorize things like Israel and prophecy and so on. So there is this issue is consistency and applying the literal hermeneutic. A second key element arises out of the first key element, which is a consistent distinction between Israel and the church. A consistent distinction between Israel and the church. And this is the most basic acid test of a dispensationalist. Because, as we'll see next week, all different forms of replacement theology, all three divisions of covenant theology mar this distinction at some point, some earlier than others. But as long as you believe Israel always means Israel, never means the church, as long as you believe God has a plan for the church and a plan for Israel that is distinctive, and it comes out of your little hermeneutic, that's ultimately what turns you into a dispensationalist. And while dispensationalism happens to be under great attack in much of the Messian movement, not in all of it, but in quite a bit of it, it's because too many of the leaders within the movement don't understand what the issue is, and they're attacking a theology that's been most supportive of Jewish things and not attacking the others, which are replacement. It was interesting to note that when non-dispensationalists look at the Messianic movement, they describe it as being dispensational. Why? Because as far as what they believe about Israel, they are very dispensational. What they observe is that critics of the movement call it dispensational, and most of the leaders claim not to be dispensational. And most leaders couldn't even define what dispensationalism even means. Fortunately, there's a third new group that has a better clarity on all this. That third element is not quite as vital, but is important. And the question here is, what is the ultimate purpose of God? It is doxological, meaning God's glory. The ultimate purpose of God is doxological, meaning his own glory. Because in non-dispensational theology, they make salvation the one unifying principle of the whole Bible, so everything is focused only on the salvation of the elect. But dispensationalism, the views of the Bible as a whole, understands that God has different plans to achieve the same goal, his own glory. And the plan of salvation is one such plan, but it's not the only plan. He's got a plan for Israel, he has a plan for the Gentile nations, he has a plan for the church, he has a plan for angels. All these different plans work towards bringing him his own glory. So for replacement theologies, we'll see next week, God, salvation is the one unifying principle of the whole purpose of God. And salvation is the only theme of Scripture. We would say, because we take the Bible literally, salvation is one major purpose of God, not the only purpose of God. Obviously, God's purpose for angels could not include salvation, nor salvation was provided. And for angels who fell and angels who did not fall don't need to be saved. But the first two points are primary. A consistent application of literal interpretation as the text demands otherwise, and a consistent distinction between Israel and the church. And the third one is not as vital, but is important. Now, taking all these three points into account, let me again quote from Rari's work, quote, "The essence of dispensationalism is the distinction between Israel and the church. This grows out of the dispensationalist's consistent employment of normal or plain interpretation, and it reflects an understanding of the basic purpose of God in all his dealings with mankind as that of glorifying himself through salvation of the purposes as well." And again, a key foundation of the whole dispensational frame of reference is progressive revelation, that God revealed his scriptures piecemeal, and therefore we must be careful not to read later revelation back to an earlier time. On one hand, you can say the evangelical world is divided between dispensationalists and non-dispensationalists, but there's another way to put this. That the Christian world is divided between consistent dispensationalists and partial dispensationalists. Why? Any believer who does not bring a blood sacrifice to church every Sunday is somewhat dispensational. Again, every believer that fails to bring a blood sacrifice to church every Sunday is somewhat dispensational, because you're already saying, well, that rule does not apply to me. So the real issue is those who are consistent dispensationalists are against partial or inconsistent dispensationalists, because even those who keep claiming the laws for us today have to make major adjustments to make it fit. But that belongs to covenantal studies, which we'll deal with 2 weeks from now. All right, any questions on this segment? Boy, you guys are quiet today. Okay, over here.
Just what was the third point under, what is it?
Third point under what?
You said, okay, God's glory?
Yes, God's glory was God's ultimate purpose. Okay. Unifying principle of Scripture is the glory of God. Other questions? Now we'll survey these dispensations within this course, and then we'll come back to them in a more detailed format as far as rules of life when we do the covenants beginning 2 weeks from now. As regards to these different dispensations, we'll go through these seven things: chief person, name, responsibility, test, failure, judgment, and grace. your outline, the first dispensation goes by two different names. It's sometimes called the dispensation of innocency, sometimes called dispensation of freedom, which covers from Genesis chapter 1, verse 28, to chapter 3, verse 8. I believe I gave the dates in your outline, am I right? Yeah. Genesis 1, 28 to chapter 3, verse 8. The chief person is Adam. Adam was given basically the power of attorney for the whole human race. When you give a lawyer the power of attorney, give anyone the power of attorney, then his actions are your actions. And therefore, since we're all the loins of Adam at this point of time, his actions are our actions, and therefore, if he succeeds, we're successful. If he fails, then we all fail. As far as name, the name innocency emphasizes the fact of unconfirmed creaturely holiness. Unconfirmed creaturely holiness. Adam and Eve were created holy, but it was unconfirmed creaturely holiness. It would be confirmed only if they passed the period of testing. And previously, for example, God created all the angels in the same state. Angels were created all at one time, since they don't give birth or generate or regenerate. And all were created perfect and holy, but they were given the power of contrary choice, the ability to choose contrary to their nature. And when Satan revolted, he was followed by one-third of the angels, then those angels that fell with Satan were confirmed in their unholiness, while the two-thirds of the angels who did not fall were confirmed in their holiness and therefore cannot choose to sin anymore. So you'll find angels falling throughout creation. The angelic fall was a one-time fall. By the same token, Adam and Eve passed the test to have been confirmed in their holiness. Producing holy children, because they fell, they produced children inheriting their sin nature as we all did. And the second name, freedom, emphasizes that at this point, humanity, which was only considered two beings, at this point were not slaves to sin. Neither Adam or Eve were enslaved to sin. Now thirdly, concerning responsibility, the responsibility was to the Edenic covenant. I'll simply mention the covenants here. We'll detail those covenants starting 2 weeks from now. For now, the responsibility was the terms of the Edenic covenant, which in its basic essence is they were allowed to eat of any tree in the garden. The one tree they could not eat of was the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So point four, the test was obedience regarding the one and only prohibition found in the Edenic covenant. And failure came when they actually partook of the forbidden tree. There's a Jewish story that as Adam's sons, Cain and Abel, were growing up, he would take them on walks to give them spiritual truth, and when he felt they were ready for it, he brought them by the Garden of Eden. They could not go in anymore, but they could look over the fence, they could see how nice and beautiful and lush it was inside. And Adam said to his two sons, "You see how nice it is in there? Well, that's where your mother ate us out of house and home." Was released a judgment, point six. The judgment included expulsion from the garden and the Adamic curse. Now we see grace, however, in the fact that with the expulsion, God also gave the promise of a future Redeemer. And in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, Genesis 3, 15, you have the first ever messianic prophecy that someday a descendant of the woman that was tempted will come and defeat Satan. And so grace is seen in this dispensation in that there was a promise of Redeemer. The second dispensation is the dispensation of conscience, also called dispensation of self-determination, or the age of human determination. This begins in Genesis chapter 3, verse 9, through chapter 8, verse 14. Genesis 3, verse 9, through chapter 8, verse 14. The chief person is again Adam. And while Eve took priority in the fall, the responsibility is never based upon what Eve did for the human condition. The Bible always accounts Adam as being responsible because he was the responsible head. As far as the name conscience emphasizes the principle of God's administration. God governed this dispensation, this administration through the conscience of man, which told him what was right and what was wrong. We got that name primarily from Romans chapter 2, verse 15. Romans 2, verse 15, which reads as follows. In that they showed the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience bearing witness therewith, and their thoughts one with another, accusing or excusing them. So he points out, while the Jewish people are given the Mosaic law that provided a stimulus for their moral conscience, a given rule of life, the Gentiles, even the pagan Gentiles who did not have a Mosaic law, still had a conscience that gave them the basic rules of right and wrong. And even the most pagan area of the world, all these different societies all have a conscience of right and wrong. The second name is self-determination, which means that this teaches that during this period of time, individual men govern themselves. They were not under any specific human government. They governed themselves, not under any specific human government. Thirdly, concerning responsibility, they were responsible to the Adamic covenant. Fourthly, concerning the test, they are to respond to the prompting of their conscience. Will they be obedient to the dictates of their conscience? And when they fail to respond to the dictates of their conscience, will they bring a proper and acceptable sacrifice? As in Genesis chapter 3, verse 21, Genesis 3, 21, and Genesis chapter 4, verse 4, Genesis 4, 4. The principle of sacrifice you have in chapter 3, verse 21, and Jehovah God made for Adam and for his wife coats of skins and clothed them. The word for skins means animal skins, which means animal blood was shed to cover the nakedness of Adam and Eve. And in fact, the Hebrew word for atonement, kippur, simply means to cover, not to remove, but to cover. Also in Genesis 4:4, Genesis 4:4, responding with a proper sacrifice. And the fact is that when Cain and Abel brought their sacrifice, the reason why Abel's was acceptable is because his was a blood sacrifice. Cain's was unacceptable because of a lack of blood. Now, point five, failure. We see failure as early as Genesis chapter 4, verse 8. Genesis chapter 4, verse 8, we have the first act of murder. Cain kills Abel. And furthermore, it shows men began responding less and less to dictates of their conscience. In fact, as we're about to see, there was open violence, corruption, widespread evil desire in the purpose and heart of man. Genesis chapter 6, verse 5. Genesis 6, 5 reads, "And Jehovah saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." Now, point six is judgment. The judgment was the Noahic flood. But grace was seen in the fact, for example, there was still a knowledge of God's will. There was a line that retained the knowledge of God's will. We see the salvation of people like Enoch who walked with God and went into God's presence while undergoing the process of death. And we see God's grace in that he rescued one family. Noah and his wife and their three sons and their wives, eight people, were saved from the flood. As a result, not only is all humanity descendant from Adam and Eve, all humanity is also descendant from Noah and his wife. All the other human lines developing from Adam, which were quite a few, were all destroyed by the flood. Now the third dispensation is called dispensation of civil government. It begins in Genesis chapter 8, verse 15 through chapter 11, verse 32. 8:15 through 11:32 of Genesis. I go to the list again. Number one, the chief person was Noah. Secondly, concerning the name, civil government. In the Noahic covenants, we'll see when we get to the covenants, for the first time you have the giving of capital punishment required a government to determine guilt and carry out the sentence if guilt was proven. And the right of life and death gave man judicial authority to govern others. The right of life and death gave man judicial authority to govern over others. And hence it was the dispensation of civil government. The responsibility was to the Noahic covenant. Now the test involved two things. First of all, they were to rule properly. Governmental should have been a righteous government, governments actually. There should be different governments developing, ruling righteously, and secondly, to spread out. Not to stay together, but simply spread out and fill the earth. Failure is seen in both areas. Failure is seen, first of all, in that there was the attempt to establish one empire by Nimrod. And secondly, also on the Nimrod, the Tower of Babel was built to keep everybody together, to keep them from spreading out. The judgment came with the confusion of tongues. But grace has seen that there was a remnant that was preserved, especially through the Shem line, not necessarily only through the Shem line, but primarily through the Shem line. Now, the fourth dispensation also goes by two names. It is sometimes called dispensation of promise. It's sometimes called the dispensation of patriarchal rule. From Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, until Exodus chapter 18, verse 27. So Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, till Exodus chapter 18 and verse 27. Here the key person is Abraham. As far as the names, the name of dispensation of promise focuses on the revelational aspect in that the covenant God made with Abraham contained a whole list of promises that we'll enumerate when we talk about the covenants. And the New Testament looks back upon Abraham, the word promise tends to be the key word. Let me give you some examples. Romans chapter 4, verses 1 through 26. Romans 4, 1 through 26. Galatians 3, verses 15 through 19. Galatians 3, verses 15 through 19. Hebrews chapter 6, verses 13 through 15. Hebrews 6, 13 through 15. And Hebrews 11, verse 9. Hebrews 11, verse 9. The second name, patriarchal blessing, emphasizes the governmental aspect. It was ruled by patriarchs from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob. Thirdly, responsibility was to the Abrahamic covenant. And fourthly, the key test was separation from the Canaanites. Live among them, but keep yourself separate from them. For that reason, Abraham sent his servant back to Haran, to where his family was from, to find a wife for Isaac. And Abraham told his servant, even if you find no one, Isaac is never to marry a Canaanite. And then Isaac himself, after Esau married some Canaanites, Isaac sent Jacob to the same home his wife came from to find the wife for himself. But point five, then came failure, especially with Jacob's seed, in that we find them intermarrying with Canaanites. The sons of Jacob do, and so even set up business administrations and relationships with the Canaanites. And one key example given is in chapter 38 of Genesis. Genesis chapter 38 essentially interrupts the story of Joseph, because in chapter 37, Joseph is sold into Egypt, becomes a slave to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's. And then he drops the account and picks up again in chapter 39, where again Joseph is sold to Potiphar. He interrupts the Joseph story with the account of Genesis 38 with Judah, not only seeing his sons marry Canaanites, but even himself taking on Canaanite immorality. And keep in mind that Judah happened to be the messianic line. That's why he was chosen. It was happening to the messianic line, was happening to the other lines of Joseph, of Jacob's family. So then came number six, judgment, which was the Egyptian bondage. And what provided for the Egyptian bondage is they were separated from the Canaanites, also separated from the Egyptians, living among themselves. And grace is seen in the preservation of Israel. They're preserved religiously, and they're preserved ethnically. There was both ethnic and religious preservation. Number five, the dispensation of the Mosaic Law, which is in Exodus chapter 19 all the way till Acts chapter 1 verse 26. So in Exodus chapter 19 verse 1 all the way to Acts chapter 1 verse 26. The key person here is Moses. And the name for this dispensation is the dispensation of the law, because while there are already laws given previously, commandments given previously, but now you have a unique manifestation of a legal system, because what God gave to Moses is 613 commandments. It's important to remember, God, the Ten Commandments is not the totality of the Mosaic Law. It's the first ten, but altogether, there are 613 commandments. Now, thirdly, responsibility. They're responsible to the Mosaic covenant, which contained the Mosaic Law. But secondly, also to be obedient to the prophets. You obeyed the law and you obeyed the prophets. The test, the fourth point, the test is to keep the whole law, as James 2.10 says, James 2.10, to fail even in one of the 613 commandments is to be in violation of the whole law. Therefore, keep the whole law. Now again, if there was failure, there was a blood sacrifice to deal with the failure. A second part of the test was to obey the prophets who would further expound upon the law. A third part of the test, however, is to accept the Messiah who will be the prophet like unto Moses. To accept the Messiah who will end up being the prophet like unto Moses. In Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 15 through 19, Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 15 through 19. So sixth came the judgment. Excuse me, I skipped something, the failure. Yeah, fifthly, the failure. First of all, they failed to keep the law as we see from Romans 10, verses 1 through 3. Romans 10, verses 1 through 3. Secondly, they were disobedient to the prophets. Disobedient to the prophets, as we see in 1st, 2nd Chronicles, chapter 36, verses 14 through 16. 2 Chronicles 36, verses 14 through 16. And thirdly, they also failed to accept the Messiah. Failed to accept the Messiah when he was here. Matthew 23, verses 1 through 39. Matthew 23, verses 1 through 39. So sixthly came the judgment, which involved judgments within the dispensation. For example, in the days of the judges, the book of Judges, there was subjugation by different groups. Later came the Assyrian captivity of the northern kingdom, and later the Babylonian captivity of the southern kingdom. And the final judgment was the worldwide dispersion of AD 70 with the Roman destruction of the city and the temple. Now seven, concerning grace. Grace is seen in that the Mosaic Law had a detailed sacrificial system to help restore the sinner's relationship back to God. Furthermore, God provided judges, kings, and prophets to give them righteous revelation, righteous leadership. And furthermore, the Messiah predicted in the second dispensation, or the transition between the first and second, finally arrived and paid the penalty for sin by means of his blood. These first five dispensations are now historical in the past. Now we come to number six, the dispensation of grace. From Acts 2, verse 1, until Revelation chapter 19, verse 21. That's from Acts 2, verse 1, till chapter, from Acts 2, verse 1, to Revelation. Revelation chapter 19, verse 21. The key person here was the Apostle Paul, who was given the most revelation concerning this. The name of grace is based upon what we see in John chapter 1, verse 17. John 1, 17, the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ, Jesus the Messiah. And when John says law was given through Moses, again, he does not imply there were no laws previously, there were, but there was a unique display of the law under Moses. But since the law came through Jesus Christ, he's not saying there was no grace prior to Jesus, but there was a unique display of grace. So unique that involved the death of the Son of God for sin. And so now we have a unique display different from all other former displays of grace. So the responsibility is to a new covenant, which involves to accept the gift of righteousness which God offers to all men through the Messiah. To accept the gift of righteousness which God offers to all men through the Messiah. So for the test is, will man accept the gift? Will man accept this free gift of righteousness to the Messiah? So fifthly comes failure. The fact is that a minority among Jews, the minority among Gentiles accept, but the majority of Jews, the majority of Gentiles do not accept. So most will reject. And furthermore, even the church, which is supposed to be comprised of those who do accept the gift, the Testament predicts in the last days the church will go apostate. Not everybody, but a large part of the church will go apostate, as it has already happened. Sixthly, the judgment is the Great Tribulation. And the seven-year tribulation is a lengthy judgment period that will bring to an end the dispensation of grace. As far as the display of grace, we see displayed in at least three different ways. First of all, in spite of Israel's rejection of the Messiah, Jews are still coming to faith. And there are, therefore, Jews in this audience. Jewish people are still coming to faith. And as he promised in Romans 11, 1 through 10, Romans 11, 1 through 10, there will still be a remnant according to the election of grace. But secondly, there is now widespread Gentile salvation. Whereas up until the age of grace, most believers through most of the Old Testament were Jews. Now most believers since then have been Gentiles. And the reason is given in Acts 15. In Acts 15, where he points out The major purpose for this age to call off among the Gentiles a people for his name, to call off among the Gentiles a people for his name. In Romans 11:11 through 14, another major purpose of Gentile salvation is to provoke Jews to jealousy so Jewish people will come to faith. And indeed, most Jewish believers today came to faith through Gentile witness. So throughout this age, there's both Jewish salvation and Gentile salvation. Another major act of grace as part of this age will be the rapture of the church. In the rapture, God will remove all saints from the earth before the 7 years of tribulation run their course. So on one hand, church saints that have passed away will be resurrected, and living saints will be caught up and changed from mortal to immortality, while dead ones go from corruption to incorruption. Now the seventh dispensation, the future ones, that goes by two names, is sometimes called the dispensation of the kingdom, meaning the messianic kingdom, or the millennium. In Revelation chapter 20, verses 1 through 10, Revelation 20, verses 1 through 10, the chief person here will be the Messiah himself. As far as secondly the names, the term Messianic Kingdom is more popular in Jewish circles, and it focuses on the individual that will rule this kingdom. The Messiah himself will rule this kingdom from Jerusalem. Among Gentiles, the more popular name has been Millennium, based upon the Greek term for 1,000 years. Now it emphasizes how long the kingdom will last. It will last for a millennium, for 1,000 years. That's how long this whole dispensation will last. Now, third responsibility will be to obey the Messianic King and his laws. There'll be a new rule of life, which I would call kingdom law. Responsibility will be to the King and his laws. Also include the new covenant. So the responsibility is first of all new covenant, and secondly obeying the king and the laws of the king. Fourthly, concerning the test to accept the king as savior and personal lord. To accept the king as savior and personal lord. We shall see failure because at the end of the millennium, humanity that does not have believed will participate in the revolt of Satan. And there'll be one more last revolt from all parts of the world of that day, showing failure in spite of a perfect government, perfect environment, perfect retirement benefits. There'll still be rebellion. The judgment is within the kingdom. Now those under the kingdom will all be believers, but those natural bodies will be giving birth to children, and no one is born saved even then as now. And so those born in the kingdom will be given till the 100th birthday to believe. Now if they live, they do believe, they'll live throughout the kingdom and not die, but those who do not believe will die at the age of 100. That's Isaiah 65, verse 20. Isaiah 65, verse 20. So there'll be death in the kingdom, but death will be limited to unbelievers only, even for them, only the age of 100. But the final judgment will be at the end of the kingdom with the fire from heaven destroying the invading armies. And finally, the display of grace. Note four things. First of all, there'll be the fulfillment of all unfulfilled prophecies. So what prophecies have remained unfulfilled will be finally fulfilled in the Messianic Kingdom. secondly, it also means the fulfillment of all of God's covenantal promises to Israel. As we shall see when we talk about the covenant starting 2 weeks from now, the many covenantal promises God made the Jewish people to this day have not been fulfilled, and they will be fulfilled in the context of the Messianic Kingdom. A third we see grace during this period is that of physical prosperity. Against a perfect environment, perfect government, perfect society, perfect weather. Every man lives under his vine and fig tree. Everyone has green grass in the front lawn. That probably won't need to be cut. The fourth where we see grace is that those who are born in the kingdom and do believe will not die. They will simply get their immortal glorified bodies at the end of the Messianic Kingdom, but they do not die. All right, any questions on the seven dispensations? Yes. Who's speaking? Yes. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Under promise of a test.
Yeah.
The
test was obedience to the Abrahamic covenant. Over here.
What's the verse under Mosaic law under the test, Deuteronomy?
Deuteronomy 18, verses 15 through 19. Deuteronomy 18, 15 through 19. I'm missing. I'll try again.
Under kingdom or millennium.
Yeah.
Number seven, the grace is displayed to be born, third one with physical
life. There's fulfillment of covenantal promises to Israel, yeah. Unfulfilled prophecies, fulfilled physical prosperity, and immortality. Okay. Other questions? Over here. On the name, I gave you the reason for that name, that's all.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so each of these give you the names on the outline, but on the point, on the second point of this outline here, I simply gave you the reason why the name was chosen or names were chosen. Well, if you sit down and count all the commandments God gave to Moses from Exodus chapter 20 through Deuteronomy chapter 28, you'll end up with 613. Now, I do have a list of those, if you want to see how well you're doing. I don't have those with me, but if you contact the Ariel office, that's on your letterhead.
Okay.
And not on this letterhead, this is probably the California office. Pick up the new address from the brochure back here.
Okay.
And you can talk to my secretary. Her name is Denise. And just ask that she tell you on a copy of all 613 commandments. Question?
So when Jesus referred to keep my commandments, he was referring to the 613.
No, when you talk about his commandments, we're talking about not the Mosaic commandments, but the commandments he was now giving for the new age of grace. What you find changed is happening in Matthew 12. In Matthew 12, he emphasized the Mosaic law, like a certain amount, every jot and tittle he'll fulfill, and so on. When Israel rejects him, he just laid down the principles for the new age. Matthew law mentions the new church in Matthew 16, Matthew 18. And he begins to lay down his own rules and regulations, which are part of the dispensation of grace, not dispensation of law. So now obey the commandments of the Messiah, which are often different than the Mosaic commandments. Question? Yes. Well, the seven letters point out that even dispensation of grace, you find failure. And two churches have no failure. One church has total failure, the other four have a mixture of success and failure. But that's failure not to the age of grace. So failure is always present. All right, any other questions? All right, what I want to do next week is finish up the dispensation section. We will begin to compare dispensationalism with covenant theology, and we'll see what the differences between a major representation of replacement theology and what they teach about these various subjects over against what dispensationalism teaches. And then 2 weeks from now, we'll begin with the covenants. Now, because we're slightly early, let me... I travel an awful lot, and I travel many Jewish communities, and over the years I've been able to collect many rabbi stories, because every Jewish community has their own rabbi stories. Not all rabbi stories that can be translated, and some do not translate because they're Yiddish or Hebrew wordplays, and sometimes you have to understand the Jewish community well to understand the humor. But some do translate, and so I think each night from now on I'll try to end with one of these stories. What is common to all rabbi stories is a logic there. The logic doesn't quite work right. The background to this first story I'll tell you is that in Judaism we were not taught to pray extemporaneously. So in Judaism all prayers are through prayer books. So for example, in Judaism we had a daily prayer book, there was a Sabbath prayer book, there was a special prayer book for every special occasion. Stories of a rabbi, now elderly, he's actually retired from the rabbinate. But all his life he prayed through the same prayer books, and towards the end of his life, in his old age I should say, he came to realize he did not know this God was any better now than when he first began praying through prayer books when he was just a child. He made a very unusual decision for a rabbi. He would close his book and pray with his own words. Then maybe finally he'll hear the voice of God, and if God answers him, he has a few questions to ask the Lord to get to know the God of Israel better. He closed his prayer book and began praying with his own words. He stumbled a lot in the beginning because he wasn't used to praying the way, but after a while, his words got smoother, he became more eloquent. After a long time like this, he finally heard a voice from heaven that says, "Yes, Rabbi, what do you want?" Rabbi said, "Don't ask you just a few questions to get to know you better." And God says, "So ask." "Well, my first question is, what does time mean to you?" And God says, "Time to me is something like this. 1 second is like 1 million years. 1 million years is just like 1 second. Rabbi says, "Huh. Well, my second question is, what does money mean to you?" And God says, "Similar. To me, a penny is like $1 million. $1 million to me is just like 1 penny. And Rabbi says, "In that case, oh Lord, I have a third question. May I please have one of your pennies?" And God said, "Of course. Just wait 1 second. I'll give you another one which is short, and then I'll save the others for later. This one comes from Germany. There was a small town that only had one synagogue and one Catholic church. There was only one rabbi and one priest. And one day the priest decided he would like to do something nice for the rabbi without telling him, just do something nice for him as a goodwill gesture. Happened to notice the rabbi's car was rather dirty, so he chose to wash the rabbi's car for him. And that's what the priest is doing, and the rabbi happened to look out of his second-story flat, his second-story apartment, and he saw this black-robed priest splashing all this water all over his car. Well, the day passes, and the rabbi and the priest look out of his window, and what did he see? He saw the rabbi approaching the car the priest would drive, and the rabbi's hand was a saw. And the rabbi saw several inches off the tailpipe of the priest's car. And the priest came out running, "Rabbi, Rabbi, what are you doing to my car?" Rabbi said, "Yesterday I saw you baptizing my car. Now I'm circumcising your car." More next week.